Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Ecologist and extinction guru Stuart Pym tries to be a glass-half-full kind of guy. He believes we could lose between a quarter and a half of all living species in the next century, but instead of pounding alarm bells, he's made a career of figuring out how to bring species back from the brink of extinction and to help the human species live more successfully with others. It's not easy, but from deep rainforest to the halls of power, he's hard at it. This hour, On Point famed ecologist Stuart Pym on the art of reversing the planetary epidemic of extinctions. You can join the conversation, Can You See It Happening? Will we change before we strip the planet? Are you working on it? Joining me now from Durham, North Carolina, is Stuart Pym. He's a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University and one of the world's leading experts on the process of extinction. He and his students are active in the United States and on six continents, tracking species that are up against it and finding ways to save them. He's a founder of a project called SavingSpecies.org, winner of many awards, notably the Heineken Prize for Environmental Sciences, known as the Nobel Prize of the Ecology World. Stuart Pym, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me on the program.
Your estimate is a pretty scary one there. A quarter to half the species in the world gone, possibly in a century? If I got that right, is that really what you're warning of?
Yes. In fact, I think something like that fraction of species could be on an inexorable path to extinction by the middle of this century. So we do have an extraordinary crisis that we need to attend to.
We're going to talk about some of the species that you've been out tracking, but I can't picture a world with 50% fewer species. I mean, just walking around in it, what would that feel like?
Well, you know, the story I like to think of is my great-grandkids sitting down to watch The Wizard of Oz in, you know, maybe 2050. Mm. And when Dorothy says, you know, lions and tigers and bears, oh my, I just hope that my grandkids, great-grandkids, will be able to see lions and tigers and bears in the wild. Lions have gone from almost all of India. They're in trouble across much of Africa. Polar bears are having to sort of swim for their supper because the polar ice is melting. Tigers are under huge threat across Asia. Something as simple as that, of Dorothy wondering whether the wild things will be out there, if we don't get our act together, they won't be in 50 years' time.
That gets right up to the sort of the top of any number of chains there, big mammals and beloved kind of iconic mammals. But at 50%, I'm guessing that means also down at the level of, even the microscopic, we'd be missing a lot of species.
We would be missing a lot of things. I mean, we tend to think about the charismatic mega mammals, as we call them, that people identify with. But when they go, the ecosystems, the habitats, the environments that support them go with them too. And that makes it a problem for our species because we depend on a good deal of services from nature, clean air, clean water, a whole variety of other things that nature does for us. And so losing species is just another sign that we're massively degrading our planet.
You look at the big environmental trends that are at play in that. You also look very closely species by species at what's going on. Give us an example of some of your work, your students' work recently. What are you tracking? And give us a sense of what it means. I mean, we've seen the polar bears swimming across those, it seemed like, endless expanses without ice. That's all too familiar. Paint some others for us, if you would, Stuart Pym.
Well, one of the places that that I work is in the coastal forest, the rainforests of Brazil. We've lost something like 90 or 95% of the forest there. That means that a huge number of species are at risk of extinction. And if we're going to prevent those extinctions, we have to do something to protect the existing forest and, to the extent that we can, bring the forest back by regrowing what are now often badly degraded cattle pastures and connecting the species up. The forest isn't gone completely, it's just fragmented. It's in little postage stamp, metaphorically, it's in postage stamp pieces of forest. And one of the things we can do is to try and buy up that intervening forest, or help our Brazilian colleagues to buy it up and reconnect the species so they have some sort of a future.
When you say Brazil, a lot of people will think of the Amazonian basin, but when you say 90 to 95% of the forest gone, you don't mean that entire basin, but rather specifically what the coastal forests of along the Atlantic in Brazil.
Exactly so. Brazil has not one, but two rainforests. It has the Amazon, which is huge, but under a continuing threat. And then it has a coastal forest about the size of California, Oregon, and Washington combined. And of that area, that's the one where the habitat destruction has been the most. And that's where we believe the most immediate need for conservation action should be. So we spend a lot of time in those mountains and in those forests and in those lowlands working with our Brazilian collaborators.
We want to hear about that. We've also got questions for you already. Let's get one right away, if I may, from Grafton, Massachusetts. Joe. Joe, you're on the air with Stuart Pym.
Well, thank you for taking the call. Yes, the question I have is, how do you distinguish between natural extinctions and ones that are man-made? I mean, aren't some species just gone through a natural selection?
That's a great question. You know, I often get that question, and my reply is, it's like, you know, death and taxes. You know, both are inevitable, but it's a matter of the rate. We know from studying the fossil record that a typical species lasts about a million years, which, another way of saying that is, each species should have a probability of one in a million of going extinct in a particular year. So indeed, if species were going extinct at one in a million, we might say this is just the natural rate of extinction. But the reality is that we know that species are now going extinct 100 times faster than that, and are poised to go extinct 1,000 times faster than that if we don't do something. So that means that somewhere between 99 and 99.9% of all extinctions are caused by human actions. And that's what makes this a problem. It's the tax rate of extinction is much too high.
And to what do you attribute that very rapid growth rate in the rate of extinction? How much are planetary issues, global warming? How much are much more specific, you know, farmers or would-be farmers cutting down trees just down the way?
A very large fraction of the problem is that we're cutting down habitat, that large areas of the world have been converted to human use. We are shrinking forests, particularly tropical forests, but not just tropical forests. A lot of species live in forests, and those areas are in trouble. In the ocean, we have the greatest variety in habitats like coral reefs, and coral reefs are in danger from overfishing, from global warming, from overexploitation. And so a big piece of this is, the fact that we're just destroying the homes where species live. But, you know, tragically, the one place that used to be relatively free from human intervention has been the tops of mountains. Whether you like to go up, into the Appalachians of North Carolina and Tennessee, or up into the Rockies or mountains elsewhere, you know, basically species on tops of mountains have generally been okay. We don't live on top of mountains. We don't do much on top of mountains. But, of course, if you live near a mountaintop as a species, that's exactly where you are at most risk from global warming, because as the planet warms, everything's going to move uphill, and if you're too high now, there just isn't going to be any uphill to go to in the near future.
So that's not that's a kind of pincer movement of habitat loss through deforestation, but then climate change also diminishing previously inaccessible regions.
Exactly so. So the species that are at risk in the lowlands of the world, lowland tropical forests, lowland habitats, they've been hit by habitat destruction. Their counterparts on top of mountains, which have done quite well up until now, are at the greatest risk from global warming. So these two different factors are in fact additive. They're both going to take out species.
You're looking at how to save species, and we'll talk about how that can happen and track those that are in trouble. But if a 50% loss of species is a real threat now, and you say we may be on that path by the middle of this century, what's a best-case scenario? I mean, is a quarter loss almost baked in the cake already, or could we still do better than that?
We know from the groups of species that we know best, and that's species that are familiar to us, birds and mammals and reptiles and butterflies. We know that already somewhere between 10 and 20% of those species are considered to be threatened with extinction. And threatened here is a technical word.
Mm-hmm.
It means that a species has been designated at risk by an international organization that sort of evaluates these things, the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. So we're already looking at somewhere between 10 and 20%. And that tends to ignore global warming. It tends to ignore all the future changes to the world's forests and coral reefs and so on. So, you know, this isn't a number that where people are saying, oh, it might be 1% and it might be 90%. We're talking about case-by-case studies of well-known groups and seeing what fraction of them are already in trouble.
Stuart Pym, please stand by. Behind us, the Kauai O'o, Hawaiian bird, Stuart Pym tracked. It's, as I understand it, now gone. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the global battle against species extinction, the endangered beluga whale. Behind me there, we're talking with famed ecologist Stuart Pym, who works out on the edge to track dying species and bring them back, save them. Also looks at top-level policy in a world where a lot of species are in trouble already and many more could be very soon. He joins us from Durham, North Carolina. He's a professor there at Duke University. Stuart Pym, I know you've worked on so many species, but the panther in Florida is one you've paid attention to. How's it doing?
Well, you know, it's doing very, very much better. And, you know, in all the things that we've said so far, we've been concentrating on the gloom and doom. But we Americans have a great deal to be proud of. You know, 30 or 40 years ago, you would have found it hard to see a peregrine falcon. You would have been lucky to see a whale off the West Coast. There are many, many examples where conservation science has brought species back. Whales are now a very, very important industry, not because we go out and hunt them with harpoons, but we go out and we hunt them with cameras. There's a very thriving whale-watching industry off Provincetown and Gloucester, previous whale-hunting ports, and off the West Coast. And among that group of species, some of them are now very familiar, like peregrines nesting on buildings in New York City. The Florida panther looked to be, you know, one of the most desperate. It used to occur across all of the southeastern United States, and then it was restricted to a couple of areas in Florida, Big Cypress and Everglades National Park. And colleagues, including my longtime colleague Sonny Bass of the National Park Service, decided to bring panthers in from Texas. The problem, many people thought, is that the panthers in Florida were inbred. Their population was small. They were all related to each other. They brought some female cats in from Texas, and it's been a remarkable success. There's now a lot more panthers, and they're turning up in a lot more areas across southern Florida.
Are they mainly in the successes. Yes, indeed. Are they mainly in Everglades?
They are now in Everglades. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of them are even turning up in the northern part of Key Largo. But they're mostly to a national park that's to the west of Everglades National Park called Big Cypress. If you looked at the map, you'd call it all the Everglades.
And is it possible for humans at the population we've reached on this planet, is it possible for us to live with most of the species that remain, or is it inevitable that we compete with, clash with, crush other species?
The really good news, what makes me optimistic and what makes me enthusiastic, is the future is not yet written. We do not have to give up on the variety of life on Earth. Something on the order of 3 or 4% of the planet is already devoted to our cities and our highways. Mm. About 12% of the planet is devoted to our crops and our agriculture. A big chunk of the planet we use for grazing our animals. But there's still huge areas of the planet. Think of the cold boreal forest of Canada and Russia. Deserts, grasslands, big areas of rainforest in the Congo, in Southeast Asia, in South America. There's still a lot of areas of the planet that are still in reasonably good shape. Even the places that are in bad shape are not dead. They're just dying. And if we get our act together, we can fix them and fix them effectively and quickly.
We'll talk about what getting our act together might mean in practice. Let's get a call from Reading, Massachusetts. And Will, hi, Will, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm involved in a voluntary program in Massachusetts to inventory the population of the spotted turtle. And we've had a lot of success locating where it's living. And we think that perhaps the result has been that it's actually cause it to be taken off of its status as a threatened species because we've located more places where it lives.
What kind of habitat does the spotted turtle flourish in, Will?
It lives in marshes, mostly small streams. It has an interesting habit in that it spends the summertime actually estivating. It's kind of a summertime hibernating process.
And you inventory them, meaning you go out, not in the summer, I guess, but in other seasons and sort of
Early spring is the best time, and this, the last couple of years I've been setting traps with permission of the program to try and catch them. In fact, the location where I was trapping, I didn't actually catch any at all. I caught all the other species that are more common, and so it was a little frustrating to not be able to contribute more data to the study, but I think not catching them is indicative that there is a problem.
Will, this is right up Stuart Pym's alley, the kind of work he does himself and with his students. And thanks for your story. Stuart Pym, I wish you'd share some of the techniques that you use and give us some examples of the kind of species you track, the ends of the earth you track them to, and you hear Will's disappointment in not being able to show something. You must know that one very well.
Well, first of all, good for you, Will, for doing this work. Wetlands, particularly small wetlands, are under threat all the way around the world. And going out there and inventorying a species, finding out what's there, that's hugely important. I mean, we probably spend more of our time just simply counting things, than anything else. We need to know what the situation is. And so a good deal of saving species is to go out there and find out where they live, find out how many they are. And when you've got those vital pieces of information, that gives you some sense of what you need to do. It tells you where you can act. The really sad part of the Kauai o'o, which we heard before the break, was that when people found that bird, they found one individual, probably one male. And, you know, you don't need to know much biology that if you have only one male left, you're not going to have much of a future.
I mean, what does it look like when you're at the doorstep of extinction? Is it's what the final examples of a species separated by miles so they don't reproduce? Or, you know,
yes. That's, I mean, in the case of the o'o, and it had nowhere to go. There were no other o'o. But in many cases, what we see is in the case of the Florida panther, it was clear that these individuals could be rescued genetically. We could bring some, you know, new blood into the population. But usually, it's just like arranging young people to have a date. It's sort of like getting a dance going. You've got isolated populations living here and another isolated population living there. You know, if you can regrow the forest in between, they can meet and they can quite literally go forth and multiply. And that's exactly what we're doing at Saving Species, by trying to buy up the degraded land between isolated forest fragments. We're doing that in Brazil, we're doing that in Madagascar, you know, so that these isolated populations can intermingle and they can increase in numbers.
Does near extinction change the mating behavior of creatures? Are they, I mean, in desperation, will they mate with other species to try and stick around or follow their instinct?
The brutal truth is that they have trouble mating with their own species because they become genetically damaged. They become inbred because, you know, the only individuals left in a small fragment are going to be your very close relatives. And we know that, you know, matings between brother and sister and father and daughter are really bad for a population.
What species have you seen that in, Stuart?
Well, the Florida panther was a case in point. The panthers were often shown, you look at the photographs, and they had kink tails and they had cowlicks and a number of things that made them, you know, quite clearly looked as if they were genetically damaged, and some of them clearly were. And bringing in the animals from Texas, you know, my colleagues, Sonny Bass and his colleagues, were able to reverse that.
Strengthen the whole line. Let's get a call from Portsmouth, Virginia, and Ryan. Hi, Ryan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was wondering, first I'd like to commend Duke University for their research primate center, which I've visited several times. And I was wondering if the professor could talk about how it's impacting impacting relatively isolated species like lemurs and just the future of I guess, the sub-primate category, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Ryan.
I'd be happy to talk about that. I'm on the faculty committee for the what is now called the Duke University Lemur Center. Madagascar, biologically, is really another continent, sometimes called the Eighth Continent. And we call it that because it is so biologically distinctive. Lemurs are found nowhere else. Huge numbers of birds and plants and butterflies occur in Madagascar and nowhere else on the planet. It's one of the most badly beaten up parts of the planet. And so it's the kind of place that we at Saving Species want to work.
What's the damage on Madagascar? What's it from?
The damage is deforestation. There was a magazine special, I believe it was Time magazine, a few years ago, that talked about the worst places to be. You know, the worst place to be a woman was Afghanistan under the Taliban. The worst place to be a tree was Madagascar. 90% of Madagascar's forests have been cut.
For hardwood, for furniture, for
yeah,
coal,
and, you know,
charcoal?
Quite honestly, yeah, for charcoal, and sometimes just carelessly. People living in a village next to a national park don't have any particular reason to put a fire out if it burns in the park. What do they get from the park? And we've done a couple of things there. Working with Dr. Luke Dollar, one of my former students, we've helped one village in in northwestern Madagascar, get a money from tourists. Tourists would come, see the lemurs, and go back again. They had no place to eat lunch. Luke helped the women's group in the village build a restaurant. And so now the people who come eat at the restaurant. That money goes into the village. When we first started working there, essentially none of the children were in school. Now all of them are. For a long time, they were wearing Nicholas School Duke University T-shirts or school uniforms, but at least they were in school. So there are things that you can do at the local community that that will give the people living next to these protected areas a good reason to protect them.
And the lemur population?
The lemurs are doing a lot better because their forest is not going up in smoke.
Let's take a call from Tony in Bridgehampton, New York. Hi, Tony. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, I have a big question, actually, too. Since we're doing a lot of e-waste, which means we're getting rid of computer parts and software and all the other stuff, and we're sending it over to China. I saw that last night on another show, on a national network. And plus, we're overbuilding and we're drastically overpopulating. When are we going to be extinct? And also, the tiger salamander that lives here on Long Island is also on the verge of extinction itself. What is being done? And I'm going to have to leave you on that note.
Good. Tony, thanks for calling. Several things there. But I guess the first one is the impact on humans themselves first of the extinction of other species, and Tony's worried about his own.
Well, many people are worried about, you know, what will happen to us. I have a sort of a hard-nosed view about this. And it was best summarized by Vice President Cheney a couple of years ago when he said the American way of life is non-negotiable. And it means basically that we Americans will do whatever we can to get natural resources from around the world when we need them. After all, I don't think we would have gone to war in Iraq if its principal export had been broccoli. And that means that some of us will be okay, and it's probably going to be, you know, those of us, you know, in the United States or in Europe or whatever. The question, I think, really, though, is not whether we will survive. We will. But what sort of a society we will be in? We may well have a society where there are massive inequalities, and we already have one. Something like half of the world's population lives on less than a few dollars a day, which means you don't have access to safe drinking water, you don't have security for food. It means you don't know where your food is coming from 1 month to the next. And you certainly don't have access to antibiotics and electricity. And since we work in many of those countries, we know that the world is a wretched place for a lot of people. So for me, this is an issue of stewardship, of social equality, and what we can do as scientists and dedicated people to give the people, you know, and its the planet, its biodiversity, and its peoples a future that is better than the one they have now.
So you're saying if the other species don't have quality of life, humans don't either.
Yes. You know, a lot of people sort of think of species being somehow detached from the environments in which they live. That cannot be the case. People who live, as I talked about, the village in Madagascar where we work, or the Indian groups that with which my group works in Ecuador, those people are entirely dependent on their environments in a much tighter way than we are. And so, you know, when their environments go, it's not just the species that they lose, but it's everything. It's all the services that nature does for them.
We'll go out of this segment listening to, speaking of Bolivia, Bolivia's blue-throated macaw, critically endangered there. We're joined this hour by Stuart Pym of Duke University. He works around the world to save endangered species, and there are many, maybe half, in trouble within a century, or gone, he says, if we don't do the right thing. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with much more. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Behind me there, the Kentucky crawfish frog, threatened, many species endangered, many critically endangered these days. We're talking about the global battle against species and extinction with famed ecologist Stuart Pym, who works out on the edge to track dying species and bring them back to, works to save them. Let's take a call from Salt Lake City, Utah, and Lynn. Hi, Lynn, you're on the air.
Hello. I think this is the most important issue of any on our entire planet, kind of like Gandhi said something about the morality of a nation is shown in how it treats the weakest, not the strongest. And I think that's true of the human population in regard to all the species we have dominion or domination over. And yet when I say things to people to try to get them interested in our wildlife, they have no interest whatsoever in our planet or wildlife. And I wonder if Stuart Pym is as brokenhearted as I am over this situation, and if he believes there's something that the average person can do to try to change the attitude of the human population. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lynn. Dr. Pym, what do you say to our caller in Salt Lake City about human attitude? You've wrestled with it a lot.
Well, yes, I think Lynn is exactly right when she talks about this as being a huge issue. For me, it's simply an issue of ethics, of morality. You know, what kind of world are we going to leave our children, our grandchildren, generations to come? If we're not careful, it's going to be a greatly impoverished world, and I think that's simply morally unacceptable. What happens, though, when people say, oh, yeah, you know, what can I do about it? I think the issue is that there really are a lot of things that people as individuals can do, and it's not understanding what people can do that leads them to be, leads them to be so complacent. Living more sustainably is something we can all do, and we can all do for, you know, a relatively, you know, small cost in trying to live sustainably. I'm careful what I eat. I'm careful the kind of lifestyle I adopt. I have a very good lifestyle, but I just try to make wise choices. I realize, for example, that all the carbon dioxide emissions I create by driving, and especially since I fly around the world a lot, I realize that's pollution. But I also realize that for about $1 a week, I can offset those carbon emissions by buying up pieces of degraded land and reforesting them. And so there's a lot of ways which, as individuals, we can make really quite simple choices and at the same time do a lot to improve the fate of the planet.
I should say you encourage people to do some of that degraded land buying through your website project, savingspecies.org.
Indeed. I should say, and thanks for giving me the opportunity to do that, savingspecies.org in a way doesn't exist. We are not an organization that collects money. The last thing I want to do as a university professor is to have to handle other people's money. But what we do is to act as a kind of a restaurant guide. You know, you wouldn't want to go out in a restaurant in New York or Boston or wherever without a guide to suggest where you would go and what would be good value. So what we do, and this is just a collection of scientists who have a lot of experience, is we identify around the world really good local organizations that we know work hard and are very competent and very talented, and we raise money for them. We recommend that our donors give to these organizations so that they will buy up degraded land and reforest it. The potential for that is huge. Our carbon Dioxide is not only very cheap, it's very beautiful because it saves endangered species. And, you know, $1 a week per person isn't a desperately expensive thing to do, and yet it's enough to make us, you know, gas-guzzling, you know, SUV-driving Americans carbon neutral and begin to reverse the very worrying trend of increased greenhouse gases in our atmosphere.
You can check that out at savingspecies.org. And Lynn, thanks for your call. Let's go to Peter in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask the professor if anybody has done any studies on what kind of biomedical and chemical resources we're losing by losing these species. And I guess a follow-up question to that would be if we made the populace aware of what we're potentially losing, would that help our battle?
Stuart Pym?
I'll take my question on the air.
Thank you, Peter.
Yes. The potential for biodiversity to provide an amazing variety of drugs and medicines is huge. And of course, when we destroy biodiversity, we destroy that potential. By far, the best expert on that is Professor Eric Chivian at Harvard University's Center for Global Change in the Environment. Eric is a former Nobel Peace Prize winner, and he has developed as a physician a program that looks at what biodiversity does, and particularly to inform the medical profession about what biodiversity does. Very simple example, there are wonderful, bizarre shells called cone shells that live on coral reefs around the world. Just one of the several hundred species is known to contain an amazingly potent and important painkiller, a painkiller that works really differently from all the other painkillers that we have at our disposal. And Professor Chivian has pointed out that we haven't even looked at these hundreds of other cone shell species yet. And yet, we're destroying coral reefs very, very quickly indeed. So this connection between losing biodiversity and losing the tools that the medical profession need to cure us and to help us in other ways is a very real one, and it's something we need to be very much alarmed about.
Stuart Pym, I've got an email question here from our website, onpointradio.org, from Marion. She says, I live in southeast Alabama. Unfortunately, the population here is very religiously fundamental, and any discussion of environmental issues is met with scoffing and boos. They say, she writes, it's God's will, and choose to ignore scientific studies that show our human impact on our world. What about this question of looking at things through a religious perspective? I know you do yourself, though perhaps not in the way that Marion describes.
I'm a Christian, and for me this issue is entirely an issue of Christian ethics, which I think simplifies things for me. I would recommend that she ask her friends to read the first few verses, I think, of the Gospel of St. John. God so loved the fill in the blank, that
world.
He gave his only
mm-hmm.
son.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's usually translated as world. Mm-hmm. In the original Greek, it's cosmos. And however you look at that, as a Christian, it doesn't say humans. It doesn't say, mm-hmm. People. It says the world. It says the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a clear biblical injunction that we have to, we have to think about. We have to think about ourselves, our own salvation, but we also have to think about ourselves in the context of the world and indeed the cosmos. So I think there are some very strong religious arguments that this is something that we have to take very seriously indeed.
Let's get another call from Salt Lake City. Louise, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I enjoy your program.
Thank you.
My question is the following. We know that we always have limited resources and that all the species are valuable, but how do we balance the resources that we spend, let's say, saving a bird, against the resources that we can use to save human life around the world? I do understand the importance of both, but which one we tackle first?
Louise, thank you very much. It's a great question. Stuart Pym, what do you say? The balance, how do you balance?
I think it's a false dichotomy. Mm-hmm. I think the question is, do we choose species or do we choose people? Where we work in Brazil or where we work in Ecuador or even Florida or Madagascar, particularly in the poorer countries around the world, we are working in local communities. We are working with people who are poor, but they are our friends, they're kids, they're teenagers, helpers in our work. We become very, very attached to those people. We are not saying, you know, you bad, stupid people, you're destroying your environment, you know, go away and let us look after nature. We are working with them to find alternative futures for them, whether they will have a future that will involve destroying their biological resources or one that will keep them and give them a better life. And so I think time after time after time, when you get to the front line, when you become embedded in the politics of a village or a particular place, you realize that it's all about, you know, this complex of people, their environments, and those species, and we work very hard to give them the best possible future. And that, in my experience, always involves them looking after their environment in some way, simply because they gain so much benefit from it.
Louis, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Cable, Wisconsin, and Adrian. Adrian, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just wanted to talk about that there are some rays of hope in success stories of recovery of endangered species in northern Wisconsin here. When I was growing up in the 1960s and 70s, we didn't have a gray wolf population, and that population has grown to 500-600 animals in recent years, and across the whole Great Lakes region, we now have a population of probably over 4,000 gray wolves in an area where they're down to just a few hundred in the 1960s. And I think it's due to adequate legal protection and restoration of the habitat. The forests in our area were cut over in the early 1900s, but they're coming back, and with proper management, we're able to restore that population of the gray wolves in our area.
Adrian, it's great to be reminded of that kind of success story. Stuart Pym, what do you say to the gray wolf story?
You know, it's one of many. It's a wonderful success story that the wolf is so much part of our heritage. And, you know, you can add the grey whale and the peregrine falcon and, in fact, whales, a lot of whale species in general. There are a very, very large number of stories like that. And as the questioner pointed out, it's a matter of legal protection. The Endangered Species Act in the United States over the last 30 years has done an extraordinarily good job in preventing species from going extinct and bringing some species back from the very edge. So, you know, you listen to that gray wolf, you see your gray whales migrating off the coast of California, you see those peregrine falcons, as I did when I lived in New York, you know, going after pigeons. And that's a measure of what we Americans have achieved with the Endangered Species Act. And it's something to be very proud of. And in the case of listening to gray wolves howl in the forest, it's something that to me is magical and wonderful and enriches my life.
Let's go to Hingham, Massachusetts. And Neil. Neil, you're on the air.
Hello. I just called in because I'm a I'm a nature walker, basically, always been doing it, and I took it for granted as a child, flipping over stones and seeing salamanders. And basically, I was walking around recently, you know, 10 years later, talking to a friend, saying, oh yeah, you know, they're everywhere, flipping over a rock, and none to be found. And I want to say it was actually even on the station a couple weeks ago, amphibians are going to be the first to go. Or
mm-hmm.
Wondering how true that is.
Stuart Pym, there's Neil, who's salamanders in his backyard he can't find under the stones now, and asking about amphibian future.
Yes, I mean, broadly, he's right, of course, that amphibians in general are in deep trouble worldwide. Amphibians seem to be very vulnerable to a fungal disease that seems to be spreading, perhaps aided and abetted with global warming. Amphibians often have particularly salamanders, have very small geographical ranges. They often only occur in a few places, and that makes them much more vulnerable than species that occur widely. So there is a lot of concern about salamanders. There's a lot of concern about amphibians. You know, I've been talking about the success stories because I think we do have to look at success and be proud of what we've done. But, you know, for every success, there's another 10 species out there that we have to be worried about.
We have a new administration in Washington. When you look at sort of top policy issues, areas where you hope for change that might slow down that potential loss of half our species, that shocking number we began with, what are you most focused on, Stuart Pym? I know Washington is as familiar to you as the rainforests some months here. What are you hoping for now?
Well, I think like every other American, you know, I've been thinking about what would happen if I got 30 seconds with President-elect Obama. Mm. And it would be to say 20% of the global greenhouse gases emitted annually come from destroying tropical forests. Those greenhouse gases harm us. They cause a lot of economic damage. Stopping that deforestation and replanting that forest, as we are doing with Saving Species and our private sector arm, Carbella Trust, replanting those forests, saving those forests, is not only a very cheap way of taking care of the issues of global warming, it's good for the environment, it's beautiful carbon, it saves species, and that's what I hope this administration will spend some of its time focusing on.
Working with Brazil or replanting forests right in the United States?
That we need to be replanting natural forest, not plantations of species that belong elsewhere, but replanting natural forest here within the United States, but particularly in other countries.
Globally.
Globally is going to be a very cost-effective way of taking care of what is a major environmental issue of our time.
There's Stuart Pym's word to the wise for a President-elect Obama. Behind us, the Madagascar Indri lemur endangered there. Dr. Pym, it's been absolutely wonderful speaking with you this hour. You give us a big heads up and a lot to work on. Good luck with your work. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.